ALJ. Unquestionably, the procedural history of this case is a bit non-conventional.
You can say that again.
But however non-conventional or circuitous the route to get to this point, both this court's precedent and U.S. Supreme Court precedent compel the conclusion that there is but one appropriate outcome, and that is to once and for all and finally dismiss the employee's claims. As we've briefed, there are three independent bases, standing alone, any one of them, that compels that outcome. First, the employees were granted Rule 60B6 relief, notwithstanding the operation of the exclusivity bar. Second, the employees' claims are jurisdictionally barred. And finally, the employees' claims are prohibited by the mandate rule. Barring any contrary preference with respect to the sequence, I'll take up each of those issues in that order. With respect to the exclusivity bar, the employees have suggested fairly audaciously that if there's some tension between Rule 60B and the timing provisions in Rule 60B, if that puts them in conflict with jurisdictional principles, that should not matter. I'll talk about why the jurisdictional issue forecloses that issue, but Rule 60B in and of itself is clear that if you had available to you the relief that's available under the first three provisions that are time bound by the 1 year provision, you cannot forfeit your opportunity to avail yourself of those provisions, wait beyond that 1 year period, and then say, oh, you know what? I could come up with a rationale as to why this argument or this need for relief fits within the context of Rule 60B6. This court articulated that in Gulf Coast Building Supply Company versus International Brotherhood of Electric Workers in 1972. In 2015, Judge Higginbotham happened to be on this panel. In United States versus Ferdinand, almost 40 years later, the court re-articulated that principle. And in Fernandez, the court characterized it by saying, quote, an action cannot be brought through the catch-all provision of Rule 6B6 if it could have been brought through one of the rule's first five subsections. Now, the reason I'm spending a little bit of time on what this court has articulated in Trust Circuit regarding the rule, because the employees have suggested that there's some tension between this court's articulation of the exclusivity rule relative to the way that the U.S. Supreme Court talked about the rule in the Clapperport versus United States case. And there's not. Because in Clapperport, the United States Supreme Court said if the petitioner in that case had available to him Rule 60B relief under one of the five provisions, then, quote, the petitioner could not avail himself of the broad any other clause of Rule 60B, which is, of course, a reference to Rule 60B6. So the law on this issue is settled. There's no room for reasonable disagreement with respect to that.
Can I ask you a question on this point? I take it that you, by exclusivity bar, you mean if it could have been brought under 60B1, you cannot then go to 60B6.
That's correct.
To circumvent the time period. I struggle to fully understand the district court's order here. What, in your view, did the district court believe was the mistake that justified the granting of relief under 60B, whether it be 60B1 or 60B6? Because I don't fully understand that.
As I understand the court's order, the district court recognized that but for the failure to timely perfect an appeal, the employees in theory could have benefited from the now withdrawn opinion. And that is the condition that set in motion.
So what under, I agree that makes sense. What's the mistake then that the district court felt happened that required the court to act?
I think at bottom, the district court is saying because employees, notwithstanding Fifth Circuit precedent, filed the redundant Rule 50 motion, and that lulled them into complacency to think that they did not need to.
Okay, so on that view, I think that's possible. On that view, then the mistake is a failure to understand that the second Rule 50 motion told the clock for the notice of appeal.
Did not toll.
Did not toll the clock. That's a mistake. I did not understand whether it was that was the mistake or whether it was the underlying mistake that was alluded to in the withdrawn opinion from our court about the merits issue, basically. I just didn't understand which mistake we were talking about.
I think it's the former and not the latter.
Okay.
That the thing that set the motion, all everything that we've now endured, candidly, my client, was the appellees, the employees, failure to understand the operation of the deadline to appeal. And the court trying to relieve them of that, and this would be important with respect to the jurisdiction issue, obviously, decided that notwithstanding, I recognize that this could qualify as mistake, inadvertence, excuse, neglect, not just embrace, but that was on the express criteria of B1. Those are her findings. They have not been challenged. They were not challenged in the district court. They have not been cross-petitioned by the employees, and they have not even briefed to this court that those findings were incorrect.
You're still on the first point, exclusivity bar.
That's correct.
Are you familiar with the Supreme Court's case from last year, Kemp versus U.S., and did you not cite it because it's not relevant to this? It is the case that states that mistakes of law do qualify under B1, which seems to be your argument.
You know, I will admit I am not familiar with that case. It sounds like, based upon the court's recitation, that is consistent with the position that we have overtaken. And again, the court here has expressly made a finding consistent with that, and that's not in dispute. So we will have unsettled law and uncontested fact findings that demonstrate, had they timely act, they perhaps would have been able to...
Timely act either to the district court under B1 or in the appeal, a timely appeal to us. Either way, they might have gotten the relief.
That's correct. They did not. And so they're out of luck because Rule 60B6 is not intended to allow for the kind of gamesmanship where you forfeit the relief available to you within a one-year period and then come up with a clever or not, or even earnest, it doesn't matter, justification.
Were you at the status conference after the second Edwards II ruling?
I do not believe I was, Your Honor.
I only noticed there was virtually no discussion of the mandate rule. The parties both jumped to their different views as to the bonus calculation.
I don't have a distinct recollection for that.
Your third argument is none of this can occur because we would have to unwrite Edwards II to give the relief they're asking for?
That is correct. And so I'll jump to the mandate rule and then, time permitting, I'll come back to the jurisdictional issue. The mandate rule has always meant what it says. You know, if you have a fair shot to take it up on appeal, if the entire judgment is presented to the Court of Appeals, as occurred here, and the court resolves it, whatever is either expressly or implicitly included within what was merged into the entire judgment, that's game, set, match. Here, in the original, the operative original Edwards opinion, the court wrote, and this is found at record site 7689, it is ordered and adjudged that the judgment of the district court is affirmed in part and dismissed in part. And then beyond that, the court said there's one thing and one thing only that district court, you're entitled to do upon remand. That is to tax cost against the employees. So to me, that's as express and is certainly implicit a directive as to the narrow range of things that were permissible upon remand. The employees, however, are trying to use 60B to circumvent that. There are two problems with it. First, you know, we've talked about the four abandoned claims that they never even raised in the initial appeal, though they could have. This court's ruling in Perez versus Stevenson's says the mandate rules bars litigation issues decided by the district court before going on appeal. That covers the four abandoned claims. But even with respect to the performance bonus issue that they attempted to include, but they did not timely do it, that timely perfect the appeal, you know, that covers that issue. The point of the mandate was you, by congressional edict, have no further right to merits review with respect to your cause of action. Therefore, district court, all you can do upon remand is to tax costs. You cannot use Rule 60B6, the court held in Gulf Coast Building Supply Company. You cannot use Rule 60B6 as a vehicle to circumvent the operation of the mandate.
So Judge Ramos, the mistake she made was what? Importing the standards from Rule 59? You recall the cases she cited, Spence v. Taylor?
I do recall that. I don't think that that's appropriate for a couple of reasons. One, if it's Rule 60B relief, you have to deal with the exclusivity bar. That's one problem. And just beyond that, Rule 59, Rule 60, there was no justification, and I know the employees have not argued any of the exceptions to the mandate rule. There is no basis to disregard a mandate that is clear, as clear and comprehensive as the mandate was in this matter. And I have not heard any argument for the employees to suggest otherwise. If it's okay with the panel, I'll transition back to the jurisdiction issue. As the court knows well, 28 U.S.C. 12017A is a congressional edict that is a limitation, not just on what's appropriate of the parties, but it's a limitation on what courts are allowed to do. A congressionally imposed deadline of that kind carries jurisdictional import. There are no equitable exceptions. There is no sympathy. There is no earnestness exception to it. The deadline is the deadline. As I alluded to at the outset, what the employees are attempting to do here unapologetically is to suggest that there could be some reading of Rule 60B that would allow circumvention of a jurisdictional deadline. And I'm essentially paraphrasing.
So the deadline you're talking about is the one-year deadline in Rule 60. You're not talking about the appellate deadline.
Actually, I am talking about the 30-day deadline to appeal.
And there's no good cause exception?
There is not. There are no exceptions whatsoever. The court establishes, the Supreme Court establishes as much, I believe, in 2013 in the Bowles case.
The panel just mistakenly thought it was a claims processing rule?
The first time around they did, but the panel also made that express finding that their appeal was late, very late. And we pointed it out that it's not a claims processing rule. It's a jurisdictional deadline. The panel recognized, that's right. So we have to dismiss the appeal. Now, however, employees are trying to use Rule 60B to circumvent what the original panel said. That in and of itself has implications for the mandate, but staying focused on the jurisdiction.
There could be a small category of legal errors that would qualify for 60B6 correction, yes or no?
In principle, perhaps.
Intervening change of law?
Yes. However,
no way to construe this to be that?
No way to construe this to allow them to escape the implications of the jurisdictional deadline.
Right. I guess I'm shifting back to exclusivity. I'm jumping on you. In other words, if the panel felt that it was making a decision of first impression as to who bore the burden on the bonus calculation, there's no way to say, well, that's a 60B6 extraordinary circumstance. The law changed.
I don't think so, but as far as this case is concerned, that was not the issue central to the employee's predicament. Who had the burden of proof? It was not the issue. The issue is the performance bonus issue was resolved in our favor. They did not timely perfect their appeal of it. So this is your issue again. But 60B6 says it doesn't really matter what the rationale may have been as to why you're trying to force fit your request for relief into Rule 60B6 if, again, you could have utilized the provision of Rule 60B1. And I mentioned, but I'll just highlight, the Gulf Coast ruling. I think the language is particularly powerful because it says where the reason for relief is embraced in Clause B1. So even if I did not have these expressed uncontested fact findings of the district court saying, yeah, this definitely would have qualified you under B1 if you timely acted, I would be able to make the argument to the court that, if you look at this record, it's fairly obvious that what happened here was embraced by Rule B1. Fortunately, I don't have to make that argument today because, again, I have fact findings from the court that employees, if you guys were being diligent, if you guys were paying attention, you could have availed yourself of Rule B1. You waited too long.
When you present three separate arguments, is there any sequencing issue? Would you say there's any that has to come first?
I think they're equally formidable. I mean, logically, because courts usually show more interest in jurisdictional issues, perhaps that's a place to start, and I'll flag for that because there are no exceptions to jurisdictional issues, whereas in principle, there can be some exceptions, none preserved, none argued by the employee, to the mandate rule. And Rule 60B6, it's a little bit of a murky landscape with the B1, the B6, I understand that. But the jurisdiction, all equally formidable, but the jurisdiction provision is clean.
You're more interested in the destination than the route.
Exactly. Thank you, Your Honor. With that.
You have rebuttal time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Moulton? Did I pronounce that correctly? Moulton, excuse me.
Realize in Louisiana it probably is mule talk, but I'm from Utah, so.
Where do you want to start? You've got.
Well, I wanted to start with this concept that 60B1 was ever a viable vehicle for plaintiffs. It never was. And that's because what happened was we first filed this Rule 50 and 59 motion pursuant to a briefing deadline that the court had provided to us or ordered that we had to file all post-judgment motions by March 12th, 2019. So we went ahead and filed the Rule 50 and 59 motion, despite the fact that those are typically filed after the final judgment. The court then filed the final judgment. We were concerned because the court did not mention the Rule 1559 in that final judgment. The court did, however, state very clearly that that this final judgment does not preclude the parties from seeking any other relief to which they may be entitled. We therefore filed a renewed motion, and the defendants then filed a brief opposing that motion. This was never mentioned by the defendants. The defendants filed this motion, or this brief in opposition. The court then ruled on that brief, and in that brief, they specifically brought up this idea of the nullity argument, the procedural nullity. The trial court responded, or in her order, she stated, before the court is plaintiff's renewed motion for judgment as a matter of law or in the alternative plaintiff's motion for new trial, together with defendant's response, as a preliminary matter, defendants objected to the motion as a procedural nullity because plaintiffs filed an identical motion for entry of final judgment and it was constructively denied by the entry of judgment in favor of defendants. This argument is based in part on the court's order seeking motions for judgment by March 12, 2019. The court's order was not intended to negate any aspect of post-judgment procedure challenging defendants' entitlement to judgment, such as the operation of federal rules of civil procedure 50B and 59. The court overrules the defendant's procedural objections to consideration of plaintiff's renewed motions on its merits. However, after due consideration, the court denies the motion. Now, what's particularly important about this order is, one, it set forth that the court never intended to rule on the Rule 1559 motions in her final judgment. Two, the judge accepted the renewed filing, and three, the judge ruled on the filing. Now, at that point in time, according to everything that had happened, we thought there would be no reason to file a Rule 60B1 motion. And the judges sustained had actually denied their objections, and there was no basis for us to file a 60B1 motion. After that, the case, we filed our notice of appeal based on a timeline from when the judge accepted the motions and denied the motions on their merit. And then what happened after that was, of course, the case was stayed. In their brief on the appeal, I think they had one or two sentences stating that they had argued that the late or the second five motions were filed for a procedural nullity, but that was it. And then in oral argument, they argued that I think there was one or two sentences we filed late, based on. And then once this we won the appeal, the court they then filed a motion for rehearing
Well, I don't mean to interrupt, counsel.
Sure.
But I mean, we know that.
Okay.
I mean, believe me, I remember reading the opinions coming out. The first one, okay, get to the merits. Nope, on rehearing, actually the jurisdictional issue was not a claims processing rule. It was, in fact, jurisdictional. So appeal dismissed, lack of jurisdiction. I guess the difficult, and that's, look, this is a tough procedural morass that we have here, no doubt about it. The first question I asked was, the district court in her order seemed to think that a mistake had been made and so thought that it justified Rule 60B relief. And I asked counsel opposite, well, what exactly was the mistake that the district court was concerned about? And the reason I think Judge Higginson's question got at it is, does the kind of mistake that the district court tried to remedy, does it qualify as a mistake under 60B1? Because if it does, then 60B6 relief is precluded. And so what is your understanding of the basis for the district court's order?
Well, the court gave, the reasons given by the trial court were twofold. The court said that it was, one, an intervening change in the controlling law, and two, the need to correct a clear error of law or fact.
Okay, so I'll be honest with you. The first rationale there doesn't move me because I do not understand what the development in law is. There was an opinion that was withdrawn. I don't see how that's a development in the law in any meaningful sense, or in any sense at all, actually. The second one, though, I'm more interested in. What is the mistake that the district court had in mind?
That this court determined that, as, and I can read it, but the Fifth Circuit decided that the plaintiff bore that, the opinion further demonstrated that the judgment was clearly erroneous, holding that the plaintiffs had satisfied that burden as a matter of law on the record of this case with respect to the performance bonuses.
You mean the substance of the withdrawn opinion?
Correct.
Okay. And if that's the, so that's different from what your friend on the other side said. Your friend on the other side said the district court was concerned about the error with respect to tolling the appellate deadline.
No, I don't believe that's the case.
Okay. So if you're right about that, that in fact it is the supposed mistake with respect to the underlying merits, I mean, where does that leave us? Is that a 60B1 mistake or is it something else?
No, I believe it's a 60B6 and that the court was just wrong in her understanding of the law and performance bonuses.
But are you familiar with the Kemp versus U.S. case?
No, I'm not.
Because I think that sort of squarely answers that question. A mistake of law is properly understood under 60B1.
Well, Your Honor, first of all, we ever had a chance under 60B1 within the time limit because this court...
The ruling, am I right? Disagree if I'm wrong. The ruling in front of us is 60B relief. So the question is, you accept that it can't be 60B1 because of timing. It's got to be 60B6, so that's when we have to explain why 60B1 wasn't available. Is that logic right or wrong?
Well, I do believe that it still follows under 60B6, personally. But.
And it does be, I guess this is the line of questioning Judge Duncan was asking. It follows under 60B6 because of what? If I'm correct in interpreting the Supreme Court's ruling from 2022, that mistakes of law are 60B1 cognizable, then it would have to be that this was an intervening change of law. And I'm sympathetic to the predicament that the prior two Edwards rulings put you in. Nevertheless, it's hard to see a withdrawn opinion to be law of any sort, let alone an intervening change in the law.
I think what the court is saying is that...
The court meaning the district court?
Yes, the district court.
Which you're defending?
Yes.
Okay.
I believe the district court is saying that this court's opinion, although withdrawn, is still persuasive for that court, and that she had made an error in law.
There's no doubt in my mind that that's what she's saying. Mm-hmm. The question is that, the question is that kosher? To take the second point, I think that your friend on the other side is making is that if that is the case, that was a merits issue. that you had the right to appeal, certainly, but our court has said that your appeal wasn't timely. So isn't this, in effect, trying to undo the appellate timeline, which is jurisdictional, through a 60B6 motion? What's your response to that?
Well, first of all, that, as I stated, the court made an error. And when we filed the 60B6, it was based on the fact that actually we didn't have an opportunity to brief the deadline issue on the appeal.
You mean the basis on which our court granted rehearing?
Correct. But we also argued that the court had made a mistake in the law, and so that's what we're basing it on, Your Honor.
But the relief that the district court felt it was giving was the relief that was given in Edwards 1. And Edwards 2 then says that's not available, too late. How would we not have to unwrite Edwards 2 to affirm?
I'm not sure I'm understanding.
Well, the district court, through B6, gave you the relief that you did prevail on originally in Edwards 1.
Correct.
But that's exactly the relief that our court said was asked for too late. So it would seem to me this is, I guess, pushing you to the mandate rule.
Well, I guess what you're getting to is the mandate.
Yes.
Yeah, I don't think that the mandate applies because when an appeals court dismisses an appeal for lack of jurisdiction, the appeals court doesn't delve into the merits of the substance of the case. Instead, it focuses on whether it has a legal right to hear the case based on factors like jurisdictional rules or procedural issues. The mandate in this context simply reflects that the higher court cannot proceed further and that the decision of the trial court stands. This means that the trial court's ruling prior to the appeal remains in effect. There is nothing in such a mandate that would prevent a trial court from subsequently correcting an error in its judgment via 60B6 by withdrawing its initial judgment, which was undisturbed by the higher court. To suggest otherwise injects a merit of substantive review by the appellate court that simply does not exist in such a context. It further removes the efficacy and import of Rule 60B, cutting off a trial court's ability to correct an error in its adjudication.
Okay, thank you, counsel. Yeah.
Now, I'd also like to point out that the defendant's briefing was deficient. Federal Rules of Appellate Procedure 28-8B states that the appellant's brief must contain, for each issue, a concise statement of the applicable standard of review. In reviewing their lengthy briefs, you find that defendants did not mention a standard of review a single time.
Which brief are we talking about?
Their current briefs.
Their current brief?
Yes.
Okay, not the brief in the previous panel?
No.
Okay.
As pointed out in plaintiff's brief, the decision to grant or deny under Rule 60B lies within the sound discretion of the trial court and will be reversed only for abuse of discretion. Under this standard, the trial court's decision and decision-making process need only be reasonable. While relief under 60B is considered an extraordinary remedy, the court has held that 60B should be construed in order to do substantial justice and should be construed liberally. Ultimately, this is a question of justice and whether defendant should be allowed to violate the law without consequence due to a judicial error. As the trial court stated, and no interest will be served by this court perpetuating an error in its adjudication. Case law supports that it is well within the trial court's discretion to correct a manifest error of law, and justice dictates that such error be corrected.
Thank you, Gilson.
Thank you.
Mr. Knight?
I would try to make myself useful as opposed to redundant. To just pick up on
a good idea.
Some of the key points that I understood Mr. Moulton to be making. The suggestion that perhaps what the lower court did is what crossed up the employees, That is not sufficient because in the Fernandez, I believe it's United States versus Fernandez case, this court made clear that it doesn't matter if the mistake is on the part of the court or the aggrieved party, the exclusivity bar applies nonetheless. So that would not get them there. The jurisdictional issue, which I have emphasized, that's the whole point. There are no exceptions. It doesn't matter whose fault it is. The bottom line is you need a time effective appeal. We cannot help you. And I wanted to
I think it's fair to say the district court was concerned that one of her orders had led the parties astray. Is that fair to say?
That is correct. And that very well may be true, but that is the power of this court's precedent that says that won't make a difference. That is the power of this court's under the exclusivity issue. That's the power of this court's precedent, the U.S. Supreme Court precedent on the jurisdiction issue. And on that point, I just wanted to briefly flag for the court, we cite the Sebelius case. I think that's a very useful analog because in that case, there was an agency promulgated rule that perhaps would have allowed an extension, notwithstanding the jurisdictional character. And the Supreme Court said, hey, I get the agency may have said this, but that's not going to help you. Same here with the judiciary promulgated Rule 60B issue. Judge Higginson, I agree with you. The panel would have to unwrite inappropriately the second operative ruling in the Edwards case. The mandate rule clearly prohibits that. So for all of the reasons that we have articulated, we think that the only appropriate outcome here is dismissal of this matter, again, once for all and finally.
Thank you, counsel. Both the cases submitted. We'll take a brief break. It will be brief. We'll be back within 10 minutes for the final two cases.